Welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm your host, Max Kaiser. We have a great show for you today. With us, we have Ronnie Pareles, Chief Rabbi Dr. Isaac Abraham and Yelena Rachel Alkali, Chair and Associate Professor of Sephardic Studies at the Bernard Revel Graduate School of Jewish Studies of Yeshiva University. He's here to talk to us about his new book, Narratives from the Sephardic Atlantic, Blood and Faith, published in 2016 by Indiana University Press. Ronnie, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Fantastic. So first question, how did you come to write this book?
You know, every book has so many stories in its genealogy, and the book came in, the development of it, of this book came in different stages. Part of it started with a summer in the rare book room of JTS, Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, where as a grad student, I was paid very little money, but was given very little guidance. And I was told to catalog the Spanish and Portuguese books. And I was a graduate student in Spanish Portuguese literature at NYU. And this was a nice fit. And it was great because they didn't really care what I did. They were excited whenever I came with a good question to one of the librarians about why a certain book was there. And some of the books that really caught my eye were travel books, books that were in the libraries of Jews in the Spanish-Portuguese community of Amsterdam in particular, that had to do with the wide developing world of colonialism and international trade, books of history, books of anthropology and travel tales from all over the world. And I was curious, why would these books be in a Jewish library? What's going on here? And at the same time, I was studying colonial Latin American literature and history and thinking about a lot of those travel narratives starting with Columbus and going up through, you know, to the late colonial period of Spanish and Portuguese explorers and writing about the places that they went and explaining their encounters with the New World. And I knew that there was a record of the presence of Jews and mostly crypto Jews and conversos in the Americas. We know that they were there from a mixture of people writing about it after they were there, and coming back to open Jewish communities like Amsterdam or Italy, and talking about being in the Americas. And we know about it from inquisitorial trials. We know about it from Spanish colonial officials complaining about all these godless conversos passing through with impunity to the Americas. But I was curious about these people writing their life story down. What was their experience of coming to the Americas? What was going on for them in somewhat internally? What were their impressions? And I was hungry to find some sort of literature that was produced by conversos with a Jewish consciousness and people who embraced Judaism later in their life, talking about the encounter with the Americas. And that was one of the first flickers of this project. But there was another, I would say probably a deeper one, which is that I, like many people who studied Spanish Jewish history, have had from a very young age a fascination with crypto Jews, with the story of the Muranos, and it's something I always thought, oh, maybe I would look at in some serious way. Never really knew which angle I would take with it. And then in graduate school, in a seminar, we were asked to analyze a primary source in the colonial period, and I was home for a break, and I remember my dad had this book on his shelf. My parents did business in Mexico for many years, and one of their clients gifted them a book, and it's on my shelf today. And the book is La Familia Carvajal. It's a history written in the 30s, late 30s, by Alfonso Toro, a important historian of the colonial period in Mexico. And what I was always curious about is why is this gray, very large, a very fat tome, a book called La Familia Carvajal, the Carvajal family, why does it have a menorah on it? And as a little kid, I never knew why, I never asked, I just was curious about it. And as a graduate student, I took it off the shelf finally and looked through it. And I found in the back a small autobiography written by the main protagonist of the Carbajal family, Luis de Carbajal, that blew my mind. I was this amazing, cryptic, fascinating, passionate, life, spiritual autobiography of someone, who born in Spain, moves to Mexico with his family, has a very adventurous life, and embraces his Judaism in a very passionate, forceful manner, and engages Jewish texts in a very creative way. And I thought this was such a cool, amazing work. But I shelved it and I said, okay, I don't know. That was very cool. I wrote a nice little paper and then I moved on. But later on, as I started thinking about the encounter with the Americas between the old world and the new, and thinking about my interest in autobiography, my interest in travel literature, my interest in all these different things combining, I started to slowly look for other works where people are describing their experience as crypto Jews in the Americas. And it developed from Carvajal out to include, Antonio de Montesinos, who otherwise known as Aharon Halevi, who after doing business for a few months in South America, has an experience where when he comes back to Europe, he goes to Amsterdam to Jewish community where he describes his encounter with the lost tribe of Reuben in the Andes. And that's one other story. And the last story is not an American story, but it's an Atlantic story. It's a story of a old Christian from the Azores, the Portuguese islands in the North Atlantic, who, after searching out many different religions, comes to discover Judaism and embraces it and lives as a Jew in Amsterdam for the rest of his life and writes down a fascinating story of peregrinations and transformations from the turn of the 17th century. And so they became the people I sat with and studied from and tried to understand their lives better. So that's partially what happened. And I'll just say a third angle to this whole story is that this started as a dissertation. And when I was done with the dissertation, I really thought it couldn't be improved. It was so good. I was like, it's such a good dissertation. I mean, what can you do? And I had the gift of time and as I was finishing the dissertation, I was teaching high school full time and doing other things. And I put it aside and I went on to other projects and had other things come up in my life. And I looked at the dissertation again. I still didn't know what to do with it. And I was teaching at Brandeis University in the Spanish and Latin American Studies department, at the time known as Romance Studies. And there was a social historian, Sylvia Rome, who offered to read my thesis. And we met for lunch. And in the course of that lunch, I was able to see that this is really a story about family. As much as I was younger, I thought it was a story about the individual becoming himself. They're all men that I study, about the individual finding God, finding the truth, and changing their lives and charting their own path. These are autobiographies after all, right? Actually, if you look closely, these are individuals who are like Natalie Zeman Davis, the great historian of the early modern period, talks about these are people who are deeply embedded in their families, in their societies, in their cultures, in their microcultures, and their communities. And I started thinking more and more about the text, and I realized that so much of what's animating and connecting these three sources, but also so much of what's happening in the converso Sfaradi world at the time, is a story of families, family networks, business networks that also function as spiritual networks. And one of the cool things that I saw with these texts is that all three of them are deeply embedded in their biological, socioeconomic family structures. but they also all break out of those structures via what I call in the book, not blood family, but faith families. And so, you know, you meet someone in prison and you find in an inquisitorial prison, and you find that you have this shared passion for secret Judaism together. You go through difficult experiences, you sacrifice together, and lo and behold, someone who's not part of your family, someone who's not even part of your ethnic group, who's not a converso, you can bond with, or vice versa. Someone who was born as Manuel de Cardoso de Macedo, the third subject in the book, he was born to an old Christian family. In fact, he says, you know, my father and my father's family hated Jews so much that there wouldn't be enough wood in the world for them to burn all the Jews with. You know, and lo and behold, he befriends a Jew in prison and it changes his life. So it's an interesting way how blood is so important, and yet it's not everything, that there's spirit, that there's faith, and that people create very powerful bonds that become like spiritual brothers, spiritual paternity, spiritual brotherhood, and sisterhood and motherhood in this way. So these things all kind of over time came together to inform the book.
All right. So for the rest of the interview, we might sort of turn text by text to those three authors and their autobiographies that you mentioned. So the first text you analyze in depth is Luis de Carvajal, the Younger's spiritual autobiography. Chapter 2, you look at the text themes around spiritual and social fraternity and paternity. And then in Chapter 3, you look at motherhood and sorority in this text. So tell us a bit about this.
Yeah, so Carvajal is part of a large converso family, and he becomes historically important, and not just, I guess, existentially important, because his uncle gets awarded the governorship of a territory in modern day Mexico, in the area of modern day Veracruz, in the north and northern section, northern coastal section of Mexico. At the time, it was known as the New Kingdom of León, and he's awarded the right to settle this place, to be the governor, and to pass that governorship on to an heir. He had no sons, and he came back to Spain to try to enlist family members to come join him on this colonizing mission. And from afar, it sounded very good. In actuality, the place was really a mess. It was a mixture of inhospitable desert and swamp. So it's not a promised land. However, there were very, very rich silver mines, which were a great opportunity, but also attracted tremendous marauding by nomadic natives, and had its own set of problems. So he needed people to help him settle. He needed someone to be his right-hand man, or several people to be his assistants, and he turned to his family naturally for that. And so they go as a family, a very large group of people, family members and other known, you know, other related people, on a boat to Mexico. They come, and eventually Carvajal and the whole family get found out for some of the members' crypto Judaism. Now, the governor seems to point to the fact that the governor, his uncle, who's also called Luis de Carvajal — that's why the one I study is Luis de Carvajal the Younger, his uncle is the elder. He seems to be a passionate Catholic. He seems to be someone who started out his life like a classic converso, and I'll talk a little bit about what that means in a second. He starts out his life like a classic converso, and over time seems to remake his identity into that of the classic old Christian. With the advent in the 1400s of large groups of of Jews converting to Catholicism in Spain, you start to get a backlash around the 1450s from the majority Catholic community against not Jews, but against converts. There was a sense that these converts came to Catholicism not through faith, but through either duress or opportunity, and that they, on some level, were still socioculturally and in many cases religiously Jewish, despite the fact that they now are Catholics and go to church and send their children to monasteries and convents and everything that goes with it. And so there starts to be a differentiation between who were known as old Catholics and old Christians and new Christians. And the new Christians, who were the conversos, were discriminated against in all sorts of official capacities. They were denied access to certain colleges, denied access to certain guilds, and their genealogy was recorded. And you had to prove that you were old Christian in order to belong to all sorts of important cultural and socioeconomic institutions. So one of the stigmas of the new Christian is that they were merchants. And in fact, in many cases, they were. Jews in the medieval period were dedicated themselves in many cases to small trade and overland trade, finance and things of this nature. With the opening up of the Atlantic world and these huge trade opportunities, although Jews did get into it, the people who really got into it even in a greater sense in the Iberian world were former Jews, were conversos who often through the use of large family networks developed large trading networks that were very successful and very important to the Iberian economy. And yet they were stigmatized. They were stigmatized as being men of business, men of the nation, as they were known in Portugal. And business was seen as kind of dirty Jew work, not honorable, proud work that an old Christian would do, like plowing the land or fighting in a war or, manual or artisanal trades. And so our Luis de Carvajal starts his life like a classic new Christian. He gets into business. He does Atlantic trade with his Portuguese converso partner. They get a contract to bring slaves from Western Africa and to do general trade with Western Africa. He goes to the Caribbean. He ends up marrying the daughter of his partner, which was a classic converso merchant move. And everything is pointing in the direction that he's basically going like everyone else in his class, which is merchant with a very peripatetic life, marrying endogamously, and being part of one of these interconnected communities. Yet at some point he goes on a different direction. And he throws himself into the wars of conquest and pacification, the horrendous euphemistic term that the Spanish used to talk about wars against violent natives, the wars of pacification against the Chichimecos, the nomadic native groups that were in northern Mexico. And he does very well in this endeavor, gains distinction, and gets almost the ultimate ticket out of conversodom. And of being tainted as being somewhat Jewish, he becomes a Hidalgo. He becomes someone with a title that he can pass down to his heirs. This is the golden ticket, and he thinks he's going to pull it off. But unfortunately, the rest of his family is deeply enmeshed in that wider converso world, and many of them, seemingly unknown to him, or maybe he's willingly not wanting to know. It's unclear. In the trial records, many of those family members are not just good at business and other classic converso traits, but they actually are devout crypto Jews. They're Muranos. They're people who secretly keep Judaism in some form. It just doesn't look like normative Judaism. This looks like a very idiosyncratic, but very passionate, very creative form of Judaism, and members of that family are devoutly committed to their Judaism, albeit in very different ways and with a real sliding scale of actual observance and knowledge. His nephew, who he puts in charge of his, who's going to be his heir, who's his right-hand man, who he goes on missions with and who has all these experience with, his nephew is possibly the most passionate and creative of this crypto-Jewish group, and he manages to keep it from his uncle for a very, very long time until it's too late and they're all arrested and things unravel. And so the brotherhood has to do with all sorts of – and paternity has to do with the fact how Carvajal relates to his father in the autobiography and in the trial records. That's one of the wonderful things about studying Carvajal, is that we have these very detailed trial records of the entire family that you can, from the Inquisition to inquisitorial trials, that you can compare to how he describes his world in his autobiography. And so I talk about his relationship with the father as it appears in the trials versus how it appears in the autobiography. I talk about his alternative father figures, people like his uncle, who on some level could be a model, but at the same time, is obviously a mortal enemy, a spiritual enemy. I talk about his bonding with the kindly rector of the monastery where he's placed to work. This is a person, Pedro de Oroz, who was a very learned man and who rejoiced with Luis when they would receive new volumes of great scholarship. And Luis bonded with this individual, despite the fact that Luis was behind this priest back, was secretly going into the library and copying, using his access to these major works of Christian scholarship to poach Jewish texts out of them, right? So many of these works were would be critical of Judaism, as is the wont of a lot of medieval and Renaissance Christian scholarship. It would be critical of rabbinic positions on certain interpretations of verses from the Bible. And to Luis's good fortune, the style of the medieval period was to not just refer to Maimonides, but to quote a large passage of Maimonides and then critique it. And so Luis, looking for Maimonides, or if anything Jewish, could go in and copy out sections of Maimonides or the Talmud or Rashi, and have it as part of his Jewish anthology that he would be creating, while this kindly priest gave him literally gave him the keys to the library that he was using in a counter in a pretty subversive way. He also becomes very close to his own brother that they share a lot with, but he also has a brother who's a monk with whom he has to part ways. And I analyze those engagements. And finally, I talk about two people he meets in prison. One is someone who very early on in their time in prison together in the Inquisition, this wayward monk embraces Judaism and they have a very profound spiritual experience and bonding in prison. And the last person I look at is someone who was placed in a cell to be a spy and actually worked like a spy and helped, and got information out of Luis that ended up betraying many, many, many fellow crypto Jews. And it's a real story of betrayal in light of these other stories of real connection and fellowship. One of the things that evolved as I was looking at these life stories is that, there's an absence of women in many of them. Women don't appear. These are stories about men. Once in a while, you have very few little flits of women appearing. But in Carvajal's case, that's not the case. Carvajal is extremely close to his mother and his sisters. He puts them up on a pedestal. They're spiritual models for him. And so the feminine and the place of women in his world is very important. And I look there in particular at the difference between how he describes them in the autobiography and how they themselves present themselves in their own trials and how they talk about their brother. And so there's kind of a triangulation that happens because we have the sources from the trials to better understand and better think about what was the spirituality of his sisters, not just how they played into his own life and how they were kind of these kind of ideal Jewish women, biblical style heroines that he talks about, which is an important role also. But that's kind of what I do in those two chapters on Carvajal. And thrown in there, I talk about his in-laws, and I talk about other things related, and the fact that Carvajal himself is not married. And to what extent, how does that play out?
So you then turn to look at Manuel Cardoso de Macedo. Tell us about him and the way you suggest that he wrote his way into the Jewish people.
Yeah, so here we have a person who was born to a well-to-do merchant in the Azores. And although conversos were often depicted, were often seen to be always merchants, here we have a case where we have a very devoutly Catholic, old Christian merchant. And this merchant who lives in the Azores does a lot of business with England. And so he wants his son to be fluent in English and develop more connections in England. So he sends his son in the latter part of the 16th century, the last decade, sends his teenage son to England to study English. I'm not really sure what the father thought in terms of sending off his adolescent son to the hotbed of the, you know, Protestantism and you know, the explosion of new religious ideas that were happening in England at that time, considering how devoutly Catholic his father was. But nonetheless, he sends his son there, and quickly, according to the son, he sees the truth of Protestantism, rejects Catholicism as foolish, and spends a lot of his time there not only learning English, but really embracing Protestantism, in particular Calvinism. And sure enough, on a visit home, when he's confronted by the local bishop, he declares with tremendous bravado that I'm a Calvinist, and a Calvinist I'm going to die. And so he is arrested. But the whole time in the way that Cardoso talks about it, the whole time he describes that the inquisitors are aware of his background. They're aware that he comes from a good family, that this is foolish, you know, spirit that kind of entered this adolescent, and that eventually he's going to come back to the truth. He's going to come back to the milk of the mother church that he was raised on. Those are the terms that Cardoso used to talk about his experience with the inquisitors. But sure enough, he was pretty adamant, and they send him to Lisbon to the Inquisition. And again, there he's very adamant. He describes these encounters where he proves them all wrong using very cliched Protestant arguments. This is all in the autobiography. In his trial record, which we also have his trial record, which is a gold mine, we have very little evidence of this. He seems pretty passive, and it's unclear, you know, this image of the very fiery Protestant is not so apparent in the trial records. But that could be for all sorts of reasons. But at least in his autobiography, the way he writes about that time is he's this fiery truth seeker, that will only be swayed by reason and logical proofs. And then one night he's placed in the cell with someone who's being placed there just in transit. He's part of the Diaz Milau family, a very prominent converso merchant who was accused of multiple crypto-Judaic crimes. And he had actually a little booklet, list of all the accusations against him. And in this cell, Manuel Cardoso, interested in reading and learning about new things, says, "Oh, what is that book?" And he starts reading this little book. And he says, "Wait, how can it be? There are people who actually keep the Bible." Right? He becomes this biblical-centric Protestant. He finally is meeting someone who's accused, at least, of keeping the Sabbath the way the Bible says, and keeping the dietary laws, and keeping all sorts of things like the Bible says. And this throws him into a total confusion because he says, I chose Protestantism because it's closer to the Bible, but this guy's really close, so it must be the Judaism. And he says, I never met a Jew. I never met a Jew in my life. I only heard of Jews as kind of silly, ridiculous things that were ridiculed. And so he's thrown into a state of confusion that makes him feel that leads him to actually confess to the inquisitors in order to get out of prison earlier. Because he said, if Calvinism isn't true, there's no reason for me to suffer here for it. So he pleads forgiveness and eventually is placed in a kind of a halfway home for penitence with tons of conversos who he becomes very close to and keeps on learning from. And then attempts an escape from England, escape from Lisbon with them. He's caught. He doesn't turn anyone in. He's a tough guy. Even though he's abused in prison. They try a second time. They get out. They make it to Holland and I'm sorry, not Holland directly. They go to Hamburg and then to Danzig, where he finds work with this family. Before that, upon his arrival, he undergoes a full conversion with circumcision and a new name. He's no longer Manuel Cardozo. He is Abraham Pellegrino, or otherwise known as Abraham Ger. So Abraham the wanderer, or Abraham the convert, Abraham Ger, or Hebrew for convert, and Pellegrino has a sense of pilgrim or wanderer in a spiritual sense. And this becomes his new name, his new identity. He works with this family related to the same person who first turned him on to Judaism in Lisbon. And the thing about his autobiography is he starts off with a tremendous anxiety about his blood, about his lineage. He is a person who feels that he should not be there, that because of his legacy, because of his father's and forefathers' antagonism and deep hatred towards Judaism, he should not be lucky enough to be part of God's people. He should not be lucky enough to be part of the people of the Torah and the chosen ones. How can it be that I'm here? And so I argue, and I think he would make the argument as well, that so much of the autobiography, even the things that aren't obviously dealing with this, is so much of it is proving to himself and to his readership that I belong here. I have earned my way here. I made it from being an old Christian, sunk in seething hatred for Jews and Judaism, and blind in a blind way. I've come through my own use of reason, inquiry, exploration, passion for the truth, and my courage and ability to suffer for the Jews, and for my fellow Jews. That I became, I through that experience and through writing it all down, I argue that he's writing his way into the Jewish people. It's his calling card, and it's a fascinating religious document, because you see this person transform himself in so many different ways in so many different contexts. It's a shame we don't have more from him, although maybe more will come out. We'll see. There's always more archives to discover.
Great. Your last chapter is about the narrative of Antonio de Montesinos, where you take up the central theme of brotherhood and its limits. Tell us about this.
Yes. So this is a story which is connected to one of the great early questions of modern anthropology, which is what makes any group part of the human race? And in particular, are the natives of the Americas people who the West had no notice of, could not know how to fit into their genealogies, into their histories, into their sacred books, or into their classical histories from ancient Greece or from the Bible? What do you do with them? What do you do with the Native Americans? How do they fit into your general scheme of history? And there were many theories, starting with the early early generations after Columbus, people arguing that they're people just like us, and there's no question. But most intellectuals in the 16th century, in the European context, and into the 17th century and beyond, actually were really puzzled and came and wanted to come up with theories. You had everything from their descendants of Atlantis that sunk into the sea, but someone had to go up. They're Phoenicians who got lost at sea. They're the mythic, all these different mythic peoples that you read about. They're descendants of some of the monstrous tribes that are described in John de Manville's, travel histories. You had all sorts of theories. And one of the theories that had a lot of traction was the Israelite theory, that they are descendants of the lost tribes. Lost tribes, originally were part of the 10 tribes of the northern kingdom of Israel that were banished and dispersed among the world because of their wickedness. And could it be that these people are part of that narrative? And early Spanish missionaries and explorers would hear certain native words, indigenous words, and hear Hebrew parallels. So, for instance, katzin, the Hebrew word for officer, sounded a lot like cacique, which is the native word, one of the native words for chief. Now, these things ultimately did not hold water, but they were very interesting for people who were really grabbing at whatever they could to better understand who these people were. And there were a lot of people who said they saw parallels between this group and the ancient Hebrews. So there'll be menstrual rituals that remind them of the Bible, or certain dietary things, or that they have some sort of day of rest. Whatever it is, they would find parallels. But Montesinos is the first person who, after spending time in the Americas, comes back to the old world and doesn't say that I saw people that seemed to be like lost tribes, but actually says, no, I met people who told me they're the lost tribes and they have a message for you. So there's something very new about Montesinos's narrative, which makes it almost more outlandish and difficult to wrap our 21st century heads around, for sure. It was very difficult for people to wrap their 20th and 19th century heads around. But in the 16th and 17th century and into the 18th century, this wasn't hard. This was a book which was avidly read and translated into many languages. It starts off, I'll just say a little bit more bibliographically. Montesinos goes to Europe and he decides to go to Amsterdam, which had a prominent Spanish-Portuguese Jewish community. This was a community of people very similar to Montesinos, people who were born and raised as Catholics in Portugal and Spain, lived much of their life as that, and at some point decide to leave Catholicism and leave directly the Iberian world and move to Amsterdam and embrace Judaism fully. Montesinos, when he is in South America, from the outside, he's indistinguishable from anyone else, from any other European. But he has this experience with a group of Indians who are his porters. They're carrying all the goods that he is buying and selling and transporting throughout the Andes, in what today is modern day Colombia. And they're his porters. They're having a hard day. He overhears a conversation that to him sounds like there's these cryptic messages. He doesn't fully understand them. He forgets about it until he's in a position of difficulty. He's arrested by the Inquisition in Cartagena de Indias in the port, northern Colombia, on suspicion of being a crypto Jew. While in prison, he has this strange epiphany that somehow these people, these Indian porters who were helping him, they're actually Jewish. And he can't explain it. And he's very confused by it. In fact, he says, how could people who seem so different than me, people who, racially and in so many ways, how could they be Jewish? How does that make any sense? And he says, if God gets me out of prison, I will find them and get to the bottom of this. And sure enough, He finds one of them who, after much suspicion, agrees to take him on a journey. And it's this journey where Montesinos, I argue, is transformed and leaves behind so much of his former life, leaves behind so much of the accoutrements of power and status that were his before. Although in the inside, he knew that that was always elusive because of his Converso background. But it's on this journey that he, first of all, sheds the what he refers to as the capa y espada, the cape and sword, which would mark him as a gentleman. He dresses like an Indian. He walks for 6 days with his new Indian companion. No one's schlepping his bags for him. He's doing it all his own. And he then comes to a place where there's a wide river, and from the other side come a series of canoes filled with people who embrace him. They say the Shema Yisrael with him, and they repeat a certain series of messages that are of messianic nature for the Jews of the world. And he goes, once he's completed this mission, he goes to Amsterdam, tells the Jews of Amsterdam about this, and then basically disappears. Montesinos moves to Recife, where there was a small but important Sephardic community, and he dies there, supposedly reiterating his story on his deathbed. He made no money off this. He didn't try to sell the story. The story begets a lot of play, not because of Jews, but actually because of Christians. Christians were very excited by this. This made them feel like the end was near. The tribes, the lost tribes are being found. That means that the second coming's happening, that the world's changing, the world's shifting. And they wanted to understand it better. They appealed to Menashe ben Israel, the great Spanish Portuguese rabbi, who saw that his explanations were not working and decided to write a book explaining Montesinos' narrative. But he includes the entire narrative as he had it in the book. And so I use that narrative with all the archival and textual pitfalls that are involved with using that narrative. But I use that as Montesinos' travel log of this of his own transformation, where he starts off one way and really becomes something very different. I mean, the end of his narrative is him meeting up with a small group of people who I refer to as Hebraeo Indians, this native group that, although are not part of the tribes, are allied with the tribes and are their allies in any future war against the tyrants of the world, in this case it being the Spanish. And in this meeting, in this very intimate meeting, these men come up to him and say, "There's one God. He made us all. All of us are brothers, and we're all going to be there for each other in the end. We're going to be there for that great fight." And so he ends the book, he ends his narrative where these people who at the beginning of his narrative are his servants, they're his porters, they're not his equals, they're not his brothers, they're not his allies. And in the end, there's this bond of brotherhood over this messianic vision. And this, in particular, this hatred against the tyranny of the Spanish, that bond them. And in the book, one of the things I talk about is the tension between what I think is this more universal sense of spiritual cross-ethnic brotherhood that develops in the narrative and Menashe ben Israel's actual insistence and effort in his book, Mikveh Israel, to show that if you read the narrative properly, you'll see that the Reubenites are a very small portion, that actually the majority of the Native Americans are not Jewish, and really downplaying their connection and their brotherhood with the tribe of Reuben. And so there's a tension. I mean, I think there's a tension between Menashe's cultural racism and kind of view of the world and view of the place of Jews within the hierarchy, racial hierarchy of his time, And what actually is happening in the narrative that he quotes verbatim, which is a very interesting tension, I think, that, you know, often the way something is taken and then repackaged changes its meaning. And that's the way, you know, and yet those layers of textual interpretation are still there. And textual reorientation are still there. Yeah. So I guess I leave off in a messianic tone.
That's great. Well, that's a really fascinating story. And, as you've heard, it's a really interesting book. Before we let you go, Ronnie, can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on next?
Fantastic. Thank you. So part of what I'm working on is directly related to this project, because as my book was coming out, an amazing discovery happened. Not that I had anything to do with the discovery. But Carvajal, who wrote this autobiography, amazing, amazing work of 16th century spirituality, not just Jewish spirituality, but I think really Western spirituality, and colonial Mexico, transatlantic world, all these things. This thing that he wrote, along with many other works, I mean, he had this interesting religious anthology of Jewish texts that he poached from the time in the monastery, all sorts of things. Poems. He was a very talented poet in Spanish, and all these writings in 1932 were stolen from the National Archive in Mexico. And so the trial records are still there for the most part. The majority of the trial records of the entire family, both trials are there, which is an amazing resource. And there was a copy made of the autobiography by Alfonso Toro a few years before the theft. So we have a copy of the autobiography, but until about a year ago, no one has ever seen the manuscript. No one has ever seen the original. And about a year ago, it resurfaced. And thanks to an amazingly generous and smart collector of Judaica and Americana, Mr. Milberg, in New York City, who was offered the text at auction. He said, wait, this looks funny. And he contacted the FBI and Mexican authorities, and they determined that this was the original manuscripts that were stolen in 1932. So this all surfaced just a year ago, and it's an amazing find that is thankfully back after a few months at the New York Historical Society for a wonderful exhibit. It was on display for a few months. It was digitized. And now it is back in Mexico where it belongs. I and a dear friend and colleague, my friend Jesus de Prado, who's at the UNAM, at the Autonomous University in Mexico City, we are planning to produce a critical edition of the text with a translation into English, along with a contextual commentary of the works, both looking at the historical context, religious currents that are running through it, philosophical currents that are running through it, along with philological and lexicological and codicological features. So that's a really exciting surprise that happened connected to the project. Connected to this, somewhat more connected to the book, as well as another project on the inquisitorial prison as a site of cross-cultural encounter. As I mentioned, in every case in the book, these guys meet someone who's not of their ethnicity, who's not of their intimate group, someone who's not conversos, or someone who is converso, someone who's not, you know, a different racial category, whatever it is, and that changes their life. That changes how they view the world, how they understand their own religious beliefs, how they understand their place in society. And that's all happening in the strange space, strange coercive space of the inquisitorial prison. So that's another thing I want to study. I want to better understand the mechanics of the inquisitorial prison, because there's been some great work on this, but not enough. Understand, you know, who was in there, how was communication working and things like that. But also find other cases and think about other cases where this is happening and try to see some sort of a trend. I'm not sure where that's going. I have one article related to that that should be coming out soon. And lastly, I have something which is not related in any direct way Inquisition or the Carvajals or Montesinos or any of this is I came across an amazingly really beautiful, beautiful work called, this was in my graduate school days, Espejo Fiel de Vidas. It's in English, it would be the Faithful Mirror of Life, which is a poetic translation or poetic paraphrase of the Psalms of David, done by someone who also has a very poetic name, Daniel Israel López Laguna, who started out his life in Bayonne in the south of France, moves to Portugal, is arrested for Judaizing, and in prison starts this translation in his brain, in his head. He's imagining to translate the Psalms, and then gets out, moves to Jamaica, and he finishes it in Jamaica. It's published in England in 1720. My friend Laura Liebman has done some excellent work on this. I want to look at this book and ask the question, well, why is he writing a poetic paraphrase? And why are other people writing poetic paraphrases of the Psalms? And what about other translations of the Psalms? And a bigger question about the Psalms, which is, what is their place in people's lives? Are people reading them at home? Is it something that's done as a community? Is it a very, you know, the Psalms are, like López Laguna says, they're a living mirror, right? So it's a very personal work. To what extent, you know, how does this translate? And how does it translate? I want to focus starting with the Sephardic community, the Spanish-speaking Sephardic community of the Western Sephardim, but also look at the Ladino-speaking community in the East, but also across communal lines, and also think about the wider Protestant and Catholic context. So that's a much bigger long-term project that I'm really excited to get to once I think I get more of the Inquisition out of my blood. So that's some of the stuff that I'm thinking about.
Great. And we certainly hope to have you back on New Books in Jewish Studies again. But thanks very much again for joining us.